what I think I always struggled with in the research lab was what it could mean one day for people, right? So you're doing work in a lab at a bench, and you're just not sure what it's going to go to one day. I ended up starting an Alzheimer's diagnostic imaging company called Alzeca Bio. And the platform was around developing novel imaging contrast agents that could go and tag different proteins associated with dementia. So first we looked at amyloid, eventually started looking at tau and alpha-synuclein. So you got kind of this platform where you could look at not just Alzheimer's, but Huntington's, Parkinson's, MS, et cetera, through the platform. It's in the clinic now, and to date has had some pretty interesting results that look quite promising. The issue is that as you age and as disease accumulates, these senescent cells are harder to remove. What that really means is that the immune system function that should be getting rid of these senescent cells gets compromised. And what excited me about Deciduous, despite it being very, very early in the idea phase when we started the company, was that the PI I worked with, Anil Bhushan at UCSF, had footprints or clues as to how the immune system naturally could regulate senescent cells.
When you talk about getting initial data, so when you see data and you're like, oh, I see promise, what percentage of the time does data actually translate into reality versus you're like, oh, maybe we are on the right path, but proof, because the famous saying for us data folks is, oh, the proof lies in the pudding, right? What is the process in a super nascent research space as yours in this case?
Yeah, I fully agree. It is challenging. Data will tell you clues as to what could be happening, but actually proving it in a living system is a completely different thing. If we figured out the immune system, we figured out how they clear senescent cells, none of that matters unless it actually resolves disease.
How has imaging evolved over the years, and what role do you see AI playing in imaging?
When you look at an image, so for example, we had data sets where you look at an image and say, in this brain, there is clear proof of a protein associated with Alzheimer's. In this image, there is not. So we think because of that, this image with the amyloid positive protein accumulating, that we think this one is Alzheimer's, we think this one is not, right? That's the kind of bifurcation. Now within that, it's also been shown that being amyloid positive or even tau positive at times in Alzheimer's brains doesn't always lead to cognitive impairment. I think AI in this case, or data science or machine learning, they allow you to see things that you can't see on your own.
Welcome to another episode as part of the EITF Next Wave. In continuation to our previous conversations around longevity with Jose and Fiona, today we have an interesting expert, Robin Mansukhani, who is the CEO of Deciduous Therapeutics. We'll talk more about senolytics, senescent, his career trajectory, and selfishly, I want to talk more about AI's influence in that space around imaging and whatnot. So thanks for taking the time, Robin. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Karthik. Thank you, Jose.
Robin, to get started, why don't you tell us about your career, how you got into this space, a relatively nascent space where there's a lot of influx research happening. So how did you chance upon, and was this a known trajectory, or did this happen and you were at the right place at the right time?
Yeah, I guess any startup's kind of a confluence of events, but I'll take you back to the underpinnings first and then focus on Deciduous at the latter portion of the answer. So my background is in biochemistry. I went to Case Western, and I worked in a research lab for a few years while I was in school. And, I quite enjoyed the aims of the lab. What I think I always struggled with in the research lab was what it could mean one day for people. Right. So you're doing work in a lab at a bench, and you're just not sure what it's going to go to one day. And so I think sometimes as an N of one in a research lab, you're just not sure if the work you're going to do is actually going to make it to people at some point, or if that's even the goal. So I transitioned from a research lab into working at a seed stage venture fund in Ohio. And what I loved about that is we could do company creation. So we could go to labs around the country and figure out what is really cool science, what has commercial potential to impact a lot of people, and what's a revolutionary finding on the surface. And so I did that for a little while. I had a lot of fun with it, but as we were creating companies and investing in them, I realized my true passion was actually in being part of the company, not just investing in the company or founding the company. So, fast forward, several years, I ended up starting an Alzheimer's diagnostic imaging company called Alzeca Bio. And the platform was around developing novel imaging contrast agents that could go and tag different proteins associated with dementia. So first we looked at amyloid, eventually started looking at tau and alpha-synuclein. So you got kind of this platform where you could look at not just Alzheimer's, but Huntington's, Parkinson's, MS, et cetera, through the platform. So I led that company for quite some time. It's in the clinic now, and to date has had some pretty interesting results that look quite promising. I went from that company after about 6 years, took a bit of time off, helped start a few more companies here in the Bay Area in the neurotherapeutic space, and then eventually settled on Deciduous, back to your original question. So, I thought Deciduous was interesting because I knew that the idea of senescent cells being removed, actually, well, let me go back to the beginning. So senescent cells, you know, they accumulate, they're highly pathological, and they tend to accelerate with age. But these are, you know, permanently damaged cells that typically would get removed by a healthy immune system, as it does when you're younger and when you're healthy and disease-free. The issue is that as you age and as disease accumulates, these senescent cells are harder to remove, which, and what that really means is that the immune system function that should be getting rid of these senescent cells gets compromised. And so when it gets compromised, the senescent cells accumulate and they drive disease aggressively through that mechanism. And what excited me about deciduous, despite it being very, very early in the idea phase when we started the company, was that the PI I worked with, Anil Bhushan at UCSF, had a footprints or clues as to how the immune system naturally could regulate senescent cells. So when you go to these senescence conferences, they always talk about, boy, it'd be great if we knew how the immune system did this naturally so we could just replicate that. And what I liked about Anil is that he had actually done the work to understand that process. So instead of talking about it, he actually had some data early that was interesting to suggest that the immune system could do this, and we knew and we could identify which part of the immune system could do this. And I thought that premise would not just be impactful towards one or two diseases, but would be impactful towards over 10 diseases. And so I just thought this is going to be a great way to extend health span and remove cells that, you know, really have no positive purpose that the immune system should naturally do anyway. So that's how we got here.
When you talk about getting initial data from Professor Anil, right, at UCSF, how much of it, because I'm a data guy, so when you see data and you're like, oh, I see promise, what percentage of the time does data actually translate into reality versus you're like, oh, maybe we are on the right path, but proof, because the famous saying for us data folks is, oh, the proof lies in the pudding, right? What is the process in a super nascent research space as yours in this case?
Yeah, I fully agree. It is challenging. Data will tell you clues as to what could be happening, but actually proving it in a living system is a completely different thing. So the way I look at data is it is helpful, it's supportive, and if you have enough of it, you can kind of draw enough, you can connect enough dots, triangulate what the solution could be. But in reality, the in vivo, you know, in vivo biology is complicated, and there's still so much of it, you know, we don't know. And I think the more we learn, you know, the more we realize that there is much more to learn. And so when you see initial data sets, I think one data set is interesting. I think two or three is in four and five is kind of when you start to triangulate and say, okay, there's overlap between these multiple data sets pointing at the same thing. And when you get there, then I think it gets pretty interesting. So what Anil had initially was, you know, one or two data points to say, hey, this, you know, one, we know this is possible. Two, here's a footprint that suggests a possible immune target we could go after. But beyond that, it's, you know, can you make drugs that actually do that? And if they do that, when I give a number of these talks, I always say it doesn't, you know, if we figured out the immune system, we figured out how they clear senescent cells, none of that matters unless it actually resolves disease, right? So if we find a cool mechanism or a new way to go after senescence, it's completely irrelevant unless it actually treats disease in a highly meaningful and revolutionary way. And so I think that's the part that took a few years to sort out, you know, which drugs to make, how to target them, which models to work in, and which diseases can we revolutionize with this approach. So there's enough there in the beginning, but, you know, you're taking a lot on faith, and that's the entrepreneurial journey, and there's no way around it.
Can we maybe talk a little more about the process of taking an idea, a discovery in a university into a real company? I'm sure you had to deal with licensing issues, intellectual property. How was this process like?
Yeah, you know, every university is a little bit different. I don't fault any university for wanting to get full value for the work that they have contributed. And I think in this case, you know, we worked with UCSF. It was a pretty good process. You know, it wasn't, you know, terms are, I think, are always going to feel a little bit like you're giving up too much, and they're always going to feel like we're not getting enough. You just try to make it, you try to do it in a way where you can give them some value up front, but really you should be incentivized as partners going forward, where you both benefit at the same time in proportion when the company has success, right? What you don't want to do is inhibit the company or somehow stifle the company by having terms that are unruly upfront or on an annual basis, before the company actually has resources to serve those milestone payments or those success fees. So I think just, you know, the company has success, everyone should eat, but, you know, no one should really be eating until the company actually has milestones of success that are measurable.
Okay, so let's talk about your imaging lab company that you started first. How has imaging evolved over the years, and what role do you see AI playing in imaging? Are there promises from an artificial intelligence, like something like a deep learning network, to aid in the imaging process for Alzheimer's? Or are we still talking about more conventional digital image processing work that's going on in that space?
I think it's definitely helpful. It's supportive of the whole field. So what I mean by that is, you know, when you look at an image, so for example, we had data sets where you look at an image and say, in this brain, there is clear proof proof of a protein associated with Alzheimer's. In this image, there is not. So we think because of that, this image with the amyloid positive protein accumulating, that we think this one is Alzheimer's, we think this one is not, right? That's the kind of bifurcation. Now, within that, it's also been shown that being amyloid positive or even tau positive at times in Alzheimer's brains doesn't always lead to cognitive impairment. So you're making this reach of, hey, you have these markers, they are accumulating and progressing, but the patient may not be cognitively impaired. So are the markers actually predictive or supportive of an Alzheimer's diagnosis? And I think that's where I would summarize it like this. I think AI in this case, or data science or machine learning, any of these tools we have now that we didn't have, you know, in totality 10 or 15 years ago, they allow you to see things that you can't see on your own. Does it tell you everything by itself? Could it just look at it by itself without any of the, you know, human intervention, without a biomarker that, you know, humans developed? You know, probably not. You know, that's, I think it's a nice marriage, right? Because it's like, there's one part that humans say, okay, we know this biology, we've been studying it for decades. We know it's statistically indicative of dementia. At the other hand, you know, we need to understand the gaps that we don't know. It's kind of like you don't know what you don't know in some of the images, where you're not sure, like, why is one patient who is positive versus another patient who is positive for the proteins? One is dementia, one doesn't. Like, what's the difference between the two? And sometimes I think AI, machine learning, data science can help you bridge those gaps. So I think together they're very powerful. It's a 1 + 1 = 3. I think separately they both leave a good chunk to be desired.
But I also assume that you are okay in taking in false positives and then subjecting those samples for secondary screening with the help of an expert or someone, right? Because you don't want to be wrong. So you can take the false positive and have someone secondary come and take a look at the interpretations that was done using a machine learning system.
The challenge then is you're thinking about cost and about time. And the more time you take, the worse it can get. And then cost, you know, these images are not cheap. The healthcare system in America is, you know, absurdly expensive. All, you know, and very frequent. What should be relatively straightforward procedures, you know, can be very expensive because you've got to go into the hospital, you have to get injected with contrast agents, you have to have somebody look at it. You know, you're talking about $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 for a PET scan. You know, fortunately with the MRI approach we developed, it was going to be about a quarter to a third of the cost. So we were able to help quite a bit on cost, but you still have challenges with the time to get in, people coming from far out to actually get the scans done, getting the analysis done, etc. So it's the kind of thing where if you have to keep doing multiple scans and multiple doctor visits, the efficiency and costs start to erode pretty quickly. So that's where the challenge is. That's why if you can just have an all-in-one that's efficient, that, you know, is the best version of the scan, which, you know, has some level of, you know, the human drug is in there selling. If you have the biomarker or not, you have something in the background that can kind of analyze that at a deeper level than what a human brain can see, then that becomes interesting and more efficient and ideally less expensive.
Going back to cellular senescence, diseases where senescence is involved, you mentioned that part of the process of creating the CDS therapeutics was to decide which diseases you're going to research. And as I said, senescence is involved in multiple diseases, and people have shown that it's beneficial to remove senescent cells since they produce things that affect the entire organism. So how did you circle down the diseases you're focusing right now in your pipeline?
Yeah, it's a good question. The answer is we spent a lot of time trying to do it. So it's not easy because you have to look at where senescence interesting in both a mouse and a human, but there are three large filters we used. The first filter was preclinical, second was clinical, and the third was, you know, overall market opportunity and pair behavior. I'll take a moment now to explain each bucket. So in the preclinical bucket, you're looking at which models have a good accumulation of senescent cells that are pathological, right? So that's one. Two, is there evidence in the model that if you remove these senescent cells with this approach, that it's actually going to impact disease endpoints that are tractable to the clinic? So not just do you remove senescent cells, but actually does it resolve disease in a way that's revolutionary, right? So if you have an evolutionary approach, a lot of people have evolutionary approaches. You know, I don't understand how you differentiate if you're evolutionary, not revolutionary. And then within that, you know, can you measure it in a mouse quantitatively and not qualitatively, right? So quantitative measurements are real. They're irrefutable. They're not up for debate. Qualitative, like behavior or pain measurements, sometimes even around a little bit around mobility. You know, mice are heterogeneous, right? So how they behave on Monday versus Tuesday can be different. So do you have quantitative long-term endpoints that are just fixed, right? So, you know, can you quantitatively show improvements? And then four, you know, does that model really track towards humans? So if people use the same model in an animal, and then has that model, the data they generate from that model, has it actually been successful in a human translation? So can you believe the model is a shorter way of saying it. So that's the preclinical bucket. The clinical bucket is about patient selection as a first pass, right? So can you accurately and quickly get patients, right? So which field are you operating in? Are there enough patients? Can you get them quickly? Because, you know, the longer you take to recruit patients, the more it's going to cost you. And then two, can you get the right patients, right? So in dementia, it's really hard because there's so much heterogeneity heterogeneity between dementia patients that it's hard to get actually specific Alzheimer's patients or specific other CNS disorders like Parkinson's or MS patients, because they just, there's so much heterogeneity in this patient population. So we're focused on the diabetes market, we're focused on the pulmonary fibrosis market, and the biomarkers to enroll patients, you know, are pretty clear, right? And in diabetes, you see HbA1c is elevated, you see glucose intolerance, you see high insulin resistance. In the pulmonary fibrosis, you can look at CT or PET scans and look at fibrosis in the lungs. You can look at, you know, forced vital capacity. And these are all, you know, quantitative measurements in addition to the phenotype being presented. So, you know, getting the right patient population, I think, for your clinical study is really important. And then two, it's around how quickly can you show that it works in patients in a way, again, that's quantitative, not qualitative, right? So numerically, can you improve the disease in a way that's in endpoints that are widely accepted and validated? And then subsequently, can you show that it's across, you know, the majority of the patients in your study in a way that's, you know, not going to take 4 or 5 years, but, you know, you can do in a kind of a 12-month study, should be able to tell you, is this working or is it not? And does it have side effects that are undesirable? Or is this thing looking, you know, like it could be something that patients could use safely and effectively one day? So that's kind of your clinical bucket. And then third bucket is around payer behavior. The market, is it a growing market? And what are the current treatments right now? You know, do you have a, you know, something that's going to revolutionize and become a monotherapy, or is it more of an add-on combo therapy? What do insurance companies put up for this indication? IPF is interesting because $100,000 per patient per year that's paid for by Medicare and Medicaid. So you have, you know, have a good margin there to work with as a first indication for a company. And then, you know, it's a growing market. It's not a huge market in terms of number of patients, but, you know, the payer reimbursement makes it actually quite a large market because it's such a difficult disease that has no good treatment options right now. So, you know, that's kind of on the back end, you know, what's the market look like and will insurance companies actually pay for it? Or are you going to something overly crowded where the price pressure is going to drive you down and, you know, inhibit future growth or revenue because there's too many options out there already? It's a long process, but we took that process together. We scored each data point within each filter and then came up numerically with a map of, you know, here's what makes the most sense, here's what makes the least sense. And that's how you can, you know, focus a company that's small on a couple indications and not try to do, you know, 10 at a time.
Let's take, for example, diabetes as an example in your therapy. How are you factoring comorbidities as part of your selection group? Because sometimes someone having diabetes might have an associated risk of something else on the ICD code. So are you taking that into account, or are you just saying, okay, I'm just going to focus more on the primary marker and just start treatment on that front?
Yeah, so both. It's a really good question. And this is exactly the way I think about aging and aging therapeutics. Diabetes is not a single disease. Diabetes is a systemic metabolic disorder, typically, right? So if you, it's not just about glucose intolerance or HbA1c or being obese. Typically that propagates into heart condition, liver conditions, lung conditions, kidney conditions, and even cognitive function. So diabetes is the best grab basket of all of them in terms of looking at systemic improvements in disease, right? That's why it's attractive to us, because we can design trials in diabetes where we actually look at multiple markers across multiple different organs in a single study, because most diabetes patients are having multiple organ failure or multiple organ pathology as they progress in that disease. And so with a systemic approach to activating the immune system to remove senescent cells, you know, in the periphery, meaning we should have senescence improvements or senescence regulation in multiple organs at once with this approach. We've shown that in our diabetes data combined with our lung data. So we know that we're doing this at least in a few different organ systems. We're now going to push that a little bit further and see how many we're actually hitting with this approach. But we think it's going to be a few more than even what we've shown to date. So that's why it's so attractive to us. The challenge in diabetes is that they tend to be very large trials, especially when you get to phase two. They can be long, they can be very expensive, crowded market. You know, Ozempic, Wegovy, the incretins are making a lot of splash because of the weight loss effects people are seeing. I don't believe that's going to be a sustainable approach. I believe the dose you'll need and the loss of lean muscle mass is going to end up being a downfall with those approaches. But it's not to say they can't be supplemented with other approaches like ours that can make those, that can release the, you know, reduce the dose dependence or reduce the frequency or reduce the lean muscle mass loss we're seeing with those approaches. So, but that's why it's attractive to us, because it's also, you know, massive problem in the world right now where, you know, so many people in developing and developed countries are at high risk or diabetic already. It's almost a human health call to action in a lot of ways.
So we know that senescence is a very hot field in longevity biotech. And you mentioned that deciduous stimulates the removal of senescent cells by the immune system. How is this approach different from the rest of what other companies are doing?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the underlying premise, and I'll go into other targets that I think people are focused on as well. The underlying premise is that we know the immune system, when you're healthy, can naturally regulate your senescent cells. It knows which ones to remove, which ones are pathological. That's an endogenous behavior, you know, most, you know, unless you have a deficiency in part of your immune system, you're born with. And that's why, you know, we can have, that's why aging is not happening so rapidly, right? It happens kind of very slowly over 100 plus years. So this approach that Deciduous was founded upon said, let's go understand how this was meant to be. Let's go understand how nature intended for this whole process to take place. And so we did the analysis of different senescent cells from different disease tissue types to understand that natural killer T cells can regulate senescent cells. Now, the differentiation is that before we came along and even after, people have been focused on trying to characterize a senescent cell through single pathways. What I mean by that is, you know, typically these senescent cells, when they become irreversibly damaged, they will upregulate what's called an anti-apoptotic pathway. And basically what that does is it's basically their way to stay alive. So the senescent cell is saying, hey, look, I'm irreversibly damaged, but I want to stay alive. I want to stay metabolically active and I don't want to get removed. And so what I'm going to do is upregulate what's called an anti-apoptotic, or in other words, a pro-survival pathway. And that can be BCL2, it can be P16, it can be P21, P53, beta-galactosidase. There are different ways that cells can basically remain alive through these pro-survival pathways. And so the drug approach to that has been, okay, we know these cells are bad and shouldn't remain alive and they should get removed. And so we're going to hit that pro-survival pathway with an inhibitor of that pathway. So the cell is saying, I'm going to upregulate this pro-survival pathway. The drug is saying, no, you're not. I'm going to hit that pathway and downregulate that pathway. And when I do that, your pro-survival pathway is gone and you will get removed. The issue with that is that those pro-survival pathways are not unique to senescent cells. So normal healthy cells also overexpress these anti-apoptotic or pro-survival pathways. And so if you start hitting these cells with these apoptotic pathways or these pro-survival inhibitors, you'll end up killing healthy cells and senescent cells. So, you know, with BCL2, they exist in multiple cell types. Beta-galactosidase is in immune cells. You know, P16 is in neurons and beta cells. So, like, you know, you're going to hit good healthy cells along with the bad cells. And so the long form analogy I'd give you is that it's basically chemotherapy in a lot of ways. You're going to remove some senescent cells, you're going to remove some good cells too. And so sustainably take these drugs for years and years or decades, you know, you're going to doing as much damage as you are benefit. And so it might just net out to be nothing or worse than that. And so that's the differentiation that we wanted to figure out, was how can we just reboot the immune function that was there to help us anyway.
So this reminds me of what Merck Keytruda is doing with cancer therapy, right? Like being selective with the cancerous cell rather than just giving generic purpose chemotherapy that kills both the cancerous cells and the healthy cells overall.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a perfect analogy. You know, immuno-oncology has been transformational in the cancer field. This is that for senescence and aging.
Let's dive a little into what happens to the immune system as we age. You mentioned that you target a specific type of cell in the immune system that becomes dysfunctional. Or why does the immune system let these cells, senescent cells, accumulate? What happens to the immune system?
It's a good question. It's not so much that they let it happen. It's more that as you age and with injury, it's more that they start to accumulate faster. And so when you're, you know, it's kind of like when a factory opens, right? Everything's fresh, everything runs well. You know, when you're young, it's, you know, your immune system is very active. And then if a senescent cell pops up here and there from an injury or some kind of disease you have, you know, your immune system is so active, it deals with it very effectively. But with age, your immune function starts to, you know, all of our, you know, everyone's immune system and many parts of your immune system start to slow down as we age, right? So there's, you know, basically a peak immune function at the age of 30. So we're trying to live to 100. Think about that. You have 70 years where you're kind of like on the decline, right? And so it's just normal, right? So the immune function kind of less and less and less a little every year. And then, you know, you have more injury, more risk of disease as you age. And so it kind of like starts to equal and then starts to eventually take over. And then when it takes over, that's when you start to see more accelerated aging, because now your stress cells are accumulating, your immune system saying, hey, I'm less effective than I was before. I'm still doing something, but I just can't keep up anymore. And the problem with senescent cells is that they basically become, you know, in layman's terms, contagious. And so when they start to accumulate, they give off an inflammatory profile. And the inflammatory profile is actually meant to signal the immune system for removal. The issue is that when the immune system is slowed down, it can't respond in time, and so that inflammatory profile amplifies. So these cells become contagious through cell-to-cell contact. They'll make other cells in the microenvironment that are healthy, they'll make them senescent as well, just by being in a close microenvironment. And so they start to accumulate, they start to propagate, and the immune system gets even further overwhelmed. And that's accelerated aging with respect to senescence in the immune system. And so therapeutically, the approach is very simple. Just reboot that immune system to do its job. It's very straightforward.
And how do you envision this therapeutic approach when it gets translated to the clinic? Will it be an injection every month, every couple of weeks? What would it be like?
Yeah, I think it's going to be quite intermittent. And the thing is, you know, in mice, the test cells tend to, we can make them accumulate quickly. Yeah, we can do it. You know, one of our models, we can do it, you know, with a single injury. Another model, it takes a few months with a diet model. But in humans, it tends to be very even slower than that. It tends to be years of accumulation to drive disease. It tends, you know, test cells aren't quick to accumulate in most cases. So with diet, it takes decades. With the only times they're more acute is in the case of, you know, injuries, right? So TBI or, you know, like COVID, you can get more acute accumulation of senescent cells. But typically in most indications like sarcopenia, diabetes, fibrosis, frailty, that's decades of damage. And so to answer your question, it'll depend on the indication. So if it's more acute, it'll be a more frequent treatment. But I think in most cases, it's going to be relatively intermittent. So I think I'd be surprised if it was more than twice a year. That's roughly where I think it'll fall. But like I said, there's heterogeneity in patients. In the ultimate impact is whether or not you can quantitatively treat patients in a way that's meaningful. So there's still more to be learned there. I don't have the exact answer for you as you sit here today, but the clinical studies we do in a few years will elucidate that.
So in the meantime, while research is happening in the space, because you alluded to prolonged damage that's been accumulated, at least in the case of diabetes or cardiovascular disease, what natural ingredients can people take? Because I read about curcumin having anti-inflammatory properties. There are some seeds that have anti-inflammatory properties. What is your stand on that?
I think a lot of biotech would not exist if people had healthier habits. And I say that very unapologetically as somebody in the field. I think there's certain indications where it's like, no matter what you do, you're going to have high risk, like autoimmunity, genetic risk factors. Those are things where I feel like there's nothing you can do to prevent those. But a lot of things like metabolic disease, you know, some people do have higher risk factors for metabolic disease or cardiovascular disease. And I empathize with all of that, but a lot of it is driven by just human behavior today. So the question is, what can you do to mitigate that, slow it, or treat it? I'll just give you my N of one opinion, but I think fasting, intermittent fasting is a great solution because you are giving your body a chance for autophagy. So after 12 hours of fasting, you tend to go into autophagy, where it's basically repair of your body. You know, your body needs about 12 hours to kind of clear out what you've done last. And after that, you have a period of autophagy, which is really exciting and interesting, right? So you have 12 hours, you know, from hour 12 plus, you can actually go into a state of repair. Two, it also reduces your appetite, right? If you're just going to eat less consistently, you know, caloric restriction is one of the most effective tools for aging and longevity. So we just, you know, we've increased our portion and calorie intake, you know, significantly over the last few decades. And that is driving a lot of it. Strength training, resistance training, you know, daily. I'm a big fan of like cold immersion. So cold showers, ice baths, that kind of stuff. I think there's certainly an energetic effect from that. You can build up brown fat. I haven't gotten much into the supplements yet. I am on a plant-based diet about 90% of the time. So I think I get a lot of the good vegetables and supplements kind of through my diet naturally. But, you know, I think there are people out there who believe very highly in the supplements. It can be a lot of pills though every day. Something that seems like a way to spend your time that not everyone can do. And some of the data out there is also not fully supported yet by proper peer-reviewed research. So I'd say I would be mindful of supplements while knowing that there's potential, but there's also a downside that we haven't really understood yet either. But I think typically fast, workout, eat a plant-based diet most of the time, like you'll probably be in pretty good health, or at least do a good job mitigating your risk factors.
I also hear about protein and you needing to eat a gram of protein, 2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, muscle repair and tissue repairs and all of that. Is that a way that people can have a reduced appetite because you feel satiated with ample protein consumption? Does that have a direct correlation? I know you cannot do clinical studies on this, but is there a correlation on the reduction of the prolonged impact that happens over the time?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a hard one. I think it's in popular literature that we should have, you know, this 1 gram of protein per pound or 2 grams per kilogram. And I don't know the scientific facts behind that. It feels like part of it feels like a marketing ploy to say like, you know, take all these protein supplements as a way to, because you're never going to get that much protein probably from a normal diet. You know, if we just think about it, right? So it's just, you know, I think it's a good way for like people to sell products as well. I would just say there's like an old Steve Jobs quote where it said, think of your food as medicine. So typically when I eat, I think of it like when I'm eating this, does it feel like medicine or does it feel like junk? And so I think if you just wrap your head around that, like when you go to order food, or when you make food, like what are you making and what are you eating? And does it look and feel like medicine or does it not? And if the answer is the latter, I typically don't do it, if the answer is the former, then typically I do it. So I feel like if you just follow that kind of thought process, you're probably gonna end up eating good stuff and not bad stuff more often than not. And how much protein you get, you know, that's, you know, depends on your diet, depends on your beliefs. You know, a lot of people are vegetarian or vegan now, so it's harder to find as much protein without eating meat or eggs, but it can be done. You know, legumes, beans, nuts, even a lot of vegetables have, you know, quite a bit of protein we don't appreciate. I think there's a lot of popular culture that says you have to eat like a lot of meat or a lot of animal product to get protein. I think that's actually not true at all. I think we just are mindful about what we're eating. There's plenty of protein to be found in very different sources if we put the time into it.
Any parting comments you have around the space? What should we be excited about in the next 2 to 3 years, and what's the long term outside of this research space?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, there's an old longevity conferences and meetings are always like, you know, someone always puts up the hallmarks of aging, talks about senescence, talks about mitochondria, you know, telomeres, you know, a number of different things. And I just want to point out the relevance in that. Typically, when you're starting to fix hallmarks of aging, they tend to have systemic impacts, which means what that means is you can have multiple disease indication improvements with a single approach. And so this idea that we need one drug per disease may not be true in 5 to 10 years. And so I think that's what I would look out for. So which targets have pleiotropic effects on multiple indications at once? I think that is very exciting. And I think, you know, we talk about senescence, mitochondria, telomeres, etc. Those are targets that have pleiotropic effects on the body that if you solve it systemically will have a number of downstream effects on multiple organs, multiple diseases in parallel. So that's what I'm excited about. What to be excited about, I think, is anything that's good quantitative irrefutable data. I think there's been too many studies that have been done with patient reported outcomes that are, you know, just making a huge placebo effect difficult to overcome. So I just think, you know, think about indications where you can quantitatively measure the effects in an irrefutable way. And I think that's what I would get excited about post clinical data. And I think the mouse data can be suggestive and tell you to go forward or not, but ultimately you have to do it in a person and show the same thing. Quantitative irrefutable data is where my head's at.
Data. I think data is the need of the hour for any analysis to be done. Awesome. Thank you so much, Robin. I think this was a wonderful interaction with you in learning about senescence and what deciduous therapeutics does. And for people who want to follow more about what Robin and his team does at deciduous, you'll see the link and we'll have all information on the video's description. Thank you so much, Robin, for your time.
Thank you, Karthik. Thank you, Jose.
Thank you, Robin.